From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A moment of clarity in international relations during the annual marathon press conference held by Russia's President Vladimir Putin in Moscow Thursday. This was Kate DePuri, the Moscow bureau chief of the Associated Press, asking President Putin the following question, followed by his response.
With your permission, I will ask a question in English.
The U.S. wants Russia to do more to persuade North Korea to halt its missile programs. Would Russia support tougher sanctions against North Korea? And do you think that cooperation on North Korea could warm up U.S.-Russia relations, or have you lost hope of mending them under Mr. Trump?
You're interesting people. Really. Have you noticed that your congressmen, your senators, they look so well, so nice, so handsome. They have ties and shirts, and they seem to be smart people, but they put us on the same shelf with North Korea and Iran. And at the same time, they ask the U.S. president to address the issues of North Korea and the Iranian nuclear program together with us. Are you okay? It just looks weird. It just doesn't make much sense.
Russia's president was referring to a sanctions bill that was passed in August by the U.S. Congress almost unanimously, which sanctions both Russia and North Korea, and, by the way, Iran. For more on President Putin's speech and more, we spoke with Peter Lavelle, the host of RT's Crosstalk, via Skype from Moscow Thursday. Peter, very interesting conversation with the world and President Putin, his annual ritual of sitting down for 3, 4, 5 hours with the international press and taking on all comers. And we heard the AP's station chief in Moscow.
And Vladimir Putin's reaction was it speaks to the obvious. So let me get this straight. You want us to help you with something at the same time you're sanctioning us.
Right.
And you haven't shown the public or us why you're sanctioning us.
Right. And the sanctioning, what the help that they want is, are you willing to help us do more sanctions against North Korea, as she referred to it, when, 2 months ago, Congress imposed sanctions in one bill on Russia and North Korea, and by the way, Iran. And now you want us to pile on and with North Korea.
Syria as well.
That's right.
It's the same group all of the time. But see, Don, this speaks to how the U.S. is so myopic in how it looks at the world. It's how do you help us? And we have no interest in what your concerns are. What are your concerns, Russia? What are your concerns, Mr. Putin? They've gotten so used to this. They have this habit of never seeing that other countries have sovereignty and interests, because it's really quite troubling is that if you do have sovereignty and interests, it must be a threat to the United States. I mean, I'm sorry, but it's that easy to understand. Yeah. But it's all lost in the American think tank world, in the American media, of course. I mean, we never hear when Donald Trump ordered the missile attack, the Tomahawk attack on Syria. No one in the U.S. media was told that that was illegal under international law and a violation of Syria's sovereignty. No one in the U.S. media ever talks about how Russia was invited to Syria. You never hear these things because right. That's not how the American foreign policy elite looks at the world. So Vladimir Putin's reaction was a smackdown, but it was really very true. And I just have to wonder how that AP reporter understood it. I wonder if she really did.
Yeah, I know it. And, you know, I don't think that they've had to, you know, they've been forced to engage reality at that level, the way the rest of the world has had to for many. You know, I'm thinking back to the Bush administration, and we were hearing about all these policies that they were implementing, total information awareness, full spectrum dominance, all of these things that are, I guess, legs or components of, like, complete, I hate to be redundant, but total hegemony. Dmitry Babich has been on and off in our conversations, you know, making reference to the fact that, you know, there's a totalitarianism out of this neoliberal model in terms of reach, the actual that dwarfs anything that was even imputed to the Soviet Union, let alone existed, simply because the wherewithal to dominate everything didn't exist back then the way it does now, and it wasn't exercised either, like this.
And with this totalitarian reach is absolute intolerance. You see it in domestic politics in the United States. You see it in foreign policy. If again, I go back to the S word, sovereignty. If you protect your sovereignty, then somehow you're against American hegemony. And that's as if American hegemony is something good. And actually, they wouldn't use that word in media. But I mean, everyone in the policy thinking world, they think hegemony is good. And that's what they want, because they know, and we've said this many times on your program, right, is that the unipolar moment is coming to an end, and they know it. And this explains the increased hostility, particularly towards Iran, because Iran is one big puzzle piece that they want to take off the board, because ultimately, I think for the U.S. policy elites, it's not Russia that's the ultimate challenge. It's going to be China. And they're going to want to see if they can break up the quasi-alliance that Russia and China have, which will be very, very difficult. And neither country will abandon Iran. Repeat, neither country, Russia or China, will abandon Iran. Keep that in mind.
Right. I mean, that's
it's a red line. And the Chinese and the Russians take red lines seriously. Yeah. They just don't make them up at the moment for political points. It's real.
Yeah,
I mean, it's very dangerous.
This is the point. You know, the U.S. is used to basically, you know, being able to say anything as ridiculous as possible, completely foreclose any discussion of both how ridiculous that particular thing is and also what they should be discussing instead of the ridiculous, simply by dominating the entire narrative, all of the media, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And that moment has passed. You know, RT and Sputnik, for example, from Russia, big part of the leak of that, you know, former edifice that was, you know, blocking the whole conversation within their defined parameters. And you have CGTN from China and Xinhua and, you know, other Chinese media, China Daily, that are, you know, they can't shut them off. And you've got Telesur and you've got Press TV and all of these. And so the conversation can't be limited by Washington anymore.
Right. A perfect example was our wonderful correspondent in Washington, Samira Khan.
She was great the other day. She was great at the State Department.
Wonderful. And she'll be moving to Moscow. She's going to be joining us here in Moscow shortly.
Miss New Jersey.
Yeah, she's coming over. She came. She visited us. We came enchanted, and they're moving her here. And I think she's got a great future with us. But
so,
you know, let's refresh our listeners' memory here. She confronted the State Department spokesperson about what the spokesperson said a few weeks ago, and what's happening right now is that when RT was going to be made into a foreign agent under FARA, but nothing would change. Everything will be the same. And then, of course, it's not, because the congressional credentials for RT, and I guess Sputnik, if it hasn't happened, it will happen soon, were deprived of us. And then she asked the question, but you said nothing would change. And then you look at, you know, the shame, you know, it's like looking at a dumb peasant.
Yeah, well, they don't know how to handle it. They really, they're not used to it.
Because it's a lie, okay?
Right.
And it's obvious,
right.
And you did lie. And they don't like being confronted. You have to get along. Or, you know, it's my way or the highway. There's no debate. There's no discussion. There's no nuance.
Yeah,
okay?
This
is one of the – I think I would say my primary mission on my own program, Crosstalk, is just to show the glaring hypocrisy of these things. All right? If the U.S. said, we want to rule the world because we think we're better than anyone else, and we because of our heritage, our view, and all that – you know, but don't say, you know, don't say international law and a precedent and all that. Right. I mean, you know, right. if you just want to be a bully, just say you're a bully. I mean, at right. least you'd be more transparent, you know? Right. I mean, it would be more understandable.
Right.
Yeah, it was about oil in Iraq. Yeah, it was. And it was about Gaddafi possibly creating a pan-African currency. Yeah, it was about that. Now, just say it, okay? And then it's more believable, at least.
Right. Everybody knows it anyway, except for the American people. And that's one of the more interesting parts. You know, the whole Russiagate matter, when it boils down to it, first, the real opposition to Trump from the deep state has to do, it's been exposed, you know, pretty nakedly with the fact that he prefers or threatens detente with Russia and China also, which is apparently fundamentally intolerable by the established elite here. And so they are going to unprecedented, measures that, I mean, that they've completely wasted whatever credibility the media had left in their drive to, you know, to do what they're doing to Trump. There are so many people that look at, I was looking at the numbers from the Moore-Jones race. And Moore spent a little shy of, he spent $880,000, and the Democratic candidate spent $11 million. The media was essentially calling Moore a child molester, national, international, local media, 24/7 for months. And yet, he came within a point and a half. To me, what that says is that there is absolutely no legitimacy granted by the voters to what comes out of the box anymore.
Yeah, but the thing is, Don, if you look at Judge Moore's electoral history in Alabama, every election that he's won or lost was almost by the same margin.
Right.
So all of this attention, all of this propaganda, all of this smearing, I listened to Moore's interview with Sean Hannity, which I thought was excellent journalism. Excellent. It was a really good, you know, Sean can be a real blowhard, but I mean, he did a really good interview there. And I thought that's for Alabamans to decide their make their decision on, right. Not all these other outside forces here, which I think was just really disgraceful. It's not about democracy. I think it was a local thing, and the local people made the right decision. In my opinion, if that's what they want, that's what they should get.
Right.
Okay. But the whole thing was completely blown out of proportion. And so, you know, this, it's like an epiphenomenon. Everybody's talking about something else. The people of Alabama, they say, we know Judge Moore. We voted for him before. We voted against him before. And now they may.
Hello.
Made their decision. Nothing to direct populism in the United States. Zero. It has nothing to do with any of those things. But no, you have a wall-to-wall, 24/7 punditry, particularly on the liberal channels. They have no idea what they're talking about. Really.
Yeah. And the thing, you know, again, I didn't cover that at all, and I could care less who Alabama elects to represent them. To me, the story was I look at it as the phenomenology of it. And, you know, you call it epiphenomenal. And it's exactly like that. You had, and at the core of it is the entire power, you know, the reach to the extent they have it of this total information or full spectrum dominance or whatever, didn't shake at all the behavioral patterns of the people that were targeted. And this is another indication of the loss of legitimacy of the institutions here, where the people don't believe what they're told by authorities, by the media, by, you know, all these places that are supposed to be the sources of information. And they're willing, even if something as fundamental as, okay, well, look, I don't know, is the guy a child molester or not? I don't care. They're telling me not to vote for him, so I'm going to vote for him. That's how
I'm
powerful.
I'm going to be really politically incorrect, as I always am, all right? And as far as this whole phenomenon about sexual harassment, it exists. You know it, and I know it. There's no denying of it at all. I've seen it with my own eyes throughout my life in work life.
For sure.
But you know what? You know what, Don? Where's the due process here?
There was no process.
They're destroying institutions.
That's what
I find it sickening watching this happen.
This is what I'm saying. I'm seeing an obsession.
I don't care if bad guys, you know, they lose their career and their livelihood. That's fine with me. That's right. You know, actions have consequences. But this is another hysteria. So we have Russia, Russia, Russia. Now we have harassment, harassment, harassment. Right. You know, and the media is doing this. This postmodernist order is doing this. I mean, you know, white men are the enemy of the state now. I'm really kind of generalizing here, but that's ridiculous. Okay, and I would much prefer look at Franken. Okay, I mean I find him odious. Yeah. I don't like him at all. Okay. His sanctimonious attitude about, you know, everything, and he's so very important. But I would have said, if he would have said, no, I want due process, I would have said, give the guy due process.
Of course.
All right?
I mean, but it's not about that. There's an obsession. Look, I mean, in the same way that you had people that were marching, say, in Charlottesville because they were actually opposed to having these symbols of, you know, slavery or, you know, the old South or whatever the particular symbol symbolized to people. And you say, yeah, you know, I can get behind that. However, why is it that exactly now, this statue that was there last year and 20 years ago and 50 years ago, on the list of things that needs to be done when you have millions of people unemployed, millions of people in refugee status because of U.S. foreign policy, three people a day being shot by the police in the United States, this whole list of things, why is it that today we have to rally everything around taking down a statue of Robert E. Lee? Not that I'm opposed to taking down a statue of Robert E. Lee, but who was making that priority list, and why?
It's really interesting. Two things. If a statue offends you, and if you're an African American and a statue of Robert E. Lee offends you, I understand that. Fair. But resorting to violence and vandalism, I'm against that because it's against the law.
Yeah.
You need to have a conversation about
that's
what
that
is
part too.
Done,
part.
Okay. Yeah. Also, let's keep in mind, everybody, the vast majority of Civil War statues and monuments in the Old South were paid for and put up by Democrats.
Yeah.
Remember that.
Yeah.
Remember that.
Yeah.
And also, I said two points. Here's a third point. A lot of these statues, when they were put up, they were about reconciliation.
That's true.
The worst experience in American history, the Civil War. You know, I'm sorry, but can we just kind of rub two brain cells together every once in a while before everybody jumps to conclusions and to sides? And when you're on one side, the other side is immoral. What happened to politics?
Yeah.
What happened to politics?
Well, that goes to the point that I was making, because you have this was decided to be the priority, you know, in the midst of everything that people might want to focus on. This is decided to be a priority here. Here, all of a sudden, you know, the most of paramount importance is dealing with sexual harassment. Okay, admittedly, a very serious problem and something that should have been dealt with decades ago. And it wasn't. But suddenly, at this moment, it is. And at the tail of it, of course, is, just like in each of the other situations, Trump should be impeached. And that's what they're selling. And what they're willing to do, apparently, is to take down each and every lever of their own tools of oppression in order to get Trump. Like, this is at the top of their list of priorities.
It was Russia, 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 Russian collusion. Oh, that's a dud. It fizzled out. Oh, by the way, the corruption is really in the DOJ and the FBI.
Right.
Oh, nothing to see here. Move along.
Right, next.
Number two. Next one. Collusion. Oh, collusion with the Russians.
Oops,
oh,
no. Collusion with Israel, actually.
Nothing here. You know, nothing to see here. Move along.
Right.
The third one. Now, and you know what? Going back to Franken, you know, he was, I don't know if he's going to resign or not. He's a very dodgy character.
Yeah,
I know. I thought he was a pretty good comic at one time. He made me laugh, at least. But I'm not sure he's really going to go. But, you know, here are his establishment friends in the Democratic Party. They decide, okay, will throw him under the bus, because by throwing him under the bus, we don't care what he did or didn't do. OK, but if Roy Moore wins, then we'll have grounds not to see him, which would be completely against the law.
Right.
There's no precedent for that. But this is what these liberals do. And these great values that they can't claim to hold, they're going to throw someone under the bus in case, because of the possibility that somebody, their arch rival, and we all agree, Roy Moore is really out there.
For
okay,
sure.
But that's not for us to judge. That's not, because if we're supposed to judge, then why do we need elections? Why don't we just abolish them? Okay.
Right.
Because these people in power, they know what's best. They know what's best, you know, keeping Russia as an enemy. They know best keeping Iran as an enemy. They know best by moving the American embassy to Jerusalem.
Which they're not going to do, by the way. That's not even, you know, what Trump announced wasn't even that, really.
Vulgar language in your program, but, you know, you're screwed both ways.
Yeah, right.
Because by saying it, you're screwed. By not doing it, you're screwed.
That's right.
I mean, did anybody think this through?
No,
they didn't.
I know it. And so now you have also, let's look at, for example, what the thing of the fight over Alabama was really about. And you have a couple of dimensions to it. And the one that the people that hold themselves out to be politically astute point to is that, well, it's about being able to stymie Trump in the Senate. If you swing that seat, you know, when now you got a defection here and there from a McCain or a Lindsey Graham or whatever, you know, you can stymie Trump and he won't be able to deliver anything. You'll be able to take him out. And maybe next year the Democrats will be able to gain something in both houses of the Congress. However, the real thing was about when Steve Bannon left the White House, said, I'm going to be running campaigns for the Senate next year. There are 8 Republicans that are up for re-election. I'm targeting 6 of them that are aligned with McConnell, and we're going to take control of the Senate away from McConnell. And the moment that he declared that, they shortly had the primary where Moore won, backed by Bannon, and McConnell and the Republicans and Democrats that backed his opponent lost, even though they spent 10 times as much money. And then Bannon looks across the country at McConnell and says, I'm coming to get you. And that's what the context of this last election was and is. And after everything that's happened, Moore winning or losing doesn't mitigate that for McConnell, because at a point and a half, if Bannon's going after 6 seats, he's going to probably get 3 or 4 of them, and that's going to be enough.
Yeah, the thing is that, you know, Steve Bannon is a fascinating person, and there are some things that I very much agree with him on, and some other things I think he's very short-sighted just not particularly knowledgeable about. Mm. But Steve Bannon, there's a bit of hubris here. He thinks he got Trump elected. He thinks he understands the Trump voter. I think actually Trump really does best. He may not be able to articulate it very well. He's not a very articulate person. He has an intuitive understanding. And believe it or not, I mean, people will curse me for saying this, the guy's very talented. He's multifaceted. It's quite, he's a one and only. I don't think we'll ever get to see it again.
Yeah,
it's an anomaly, but it's a fascinating.
Right.
But Bannon, I think he better be very, very careful, because I'm not sure he understands the revolt. I saw his documentary film. It's a bit off. It's a bit odd, okay, to be honest with you. There's some things in there that I think he's absolutely right about. These waves and cycles and stuff like that, I'm not so sure about as a trained historian. But I think the bigger picture is here, and actually there's a silver lining, maybe to Steve Bannon after all, is that I see both parties, you know, having really struggling how to move forward.
Right.
And I think that's a good thing. That's a good thing.
Absolutely.
Because I really want to see the death throes of the Democrats. I mean, they have betrayed their base so often and so deeply. I mean, what about the working people of America? I don't care about your gender. I don't care about your cultural preferences. I care if everybody has dignity in work. That's the most important thing. And progressives and conservatives can come together. And everybody else that doesn't want to get on that train, get lost, because you had your run.
You know, again, we're talking phenomenology here when we're talking about the situation in both of those parties, and particularly like what we saw manifest in the election last year. We saw Sanders' rise, regardless of what Sanders himself did and what Sanders himself actually is, we saw the phenomenon of disaffected Democrats rallying around an opposition candidate, as they perceived it, and lifting him up to where, really, he won. He would have been the nominee if it wasn't stolen and if he had actually defended it.
I think he could have won the presidency.
And, that's my feeling. Okay, and he could well have won, even as people were calling him a socialist, which is another phenomenon in American history. Then you have Trump, of course, not a Republican, winning the Republican primary, dusting all of the heroes.
Conservative. He's not even a conservative.
That's right. And again, disaffected Republicans. You have, I guess, inside the Republican Party, both the quote-unquote white working class and the middle class, what's left of it. Historically, that's, you know, the small business people were the, you know, foot soldiers of the Republican Party from the 30s on. And, you know, they have been promised and promised and promised, and they've been, you know, dissolving essentially as if they were in a sea of acid for decades. And so they latched on to Trump and said, you know, to hell with these people that we've been following for the last 30 or 40 years. The Democrats, the working class, has suffered the same, union labor in particular, but workers in general, and also the various quote-unquote minority groups that were constituents in the Democratic Party, who've all been promised things, and at the best, they've gotten symbology. Like they used to say in the old Horn and Hardart commercials, you can't eat atmosphere. You know, you get a black president, but you lose half to two-thirds of the accumulated wealth of black people inside the 8 years that he's in office. You've seen this with Democrats are in power with Clinton and everyone else, and the union, you know, loses membership from, you know, where were they, 20% of where they were 40 years ago. So there's disaffection among the constituents of both parties, and I think we're seeing people like...
And you have minority groups that are tired of being sold this bill of goods.
Yep.
Okay, what did you give me?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Cyclical dependence?
Right.
Okay, that's your gift to me?
Right.
No, I mean, I Larry Elder's, you know, really, really good commentator. I mean, I really enjoy listening to him because, like, understanding how we both know as Americans and race and politics is very complicated, very contentious at times, and I need to step back and I need to learn how their community see, or members of their community, I'm talking about the black community, see themselves. It's very refreshing. It's very enlightening for me. His tirade against the Democratic Party and a lot of other minority groups are saying, yeah, you guys just take us for granted. Yeah. You know, we're just your electoral fodder. And I think an important trend. And that's it for both parties here. People don't want to be taken for granted anymore. You know, this bloc will go with us. That bloc will go with them. People don't, because of political correctness, people are being forced into these boxes. And a lot of people don't want that. They have very different goals and ambitions in their lives that are not directly tied to their gender or their race. And I think this political correctness that comes from this liberal perspective is very toxic. Because it's basically a Soviet experiment creating the new man, the new woman, or the new gender. I don't know. That's not the everyday experience for the average person. The everyday experience is that how much is I'm going to get paid? Will I get a raise? How can I think about the future? Can I be in a position to think about the future of my children? Sorry, maybe that's old fashioned, but it's true.
Yeah, the more deferred that is, the stronger the impulse. I mean, it's not something that you can suffocate. People need to live indoors. They need to eat. They need to have health care and feel like they're getting an adequate education for themselves and their children, and they expect that their children will do at least as well. And when generation after generation, because that's where we're at now, sees that frustrated, they react. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing people looking
at... You see these people on the West Coast and the East Coast, they're really smug, you know, and so for some reason they think they've been anointed to preach their morality to everyone else. They never see these problems, okay? I think you should talk to people on an everyday basis all over the country. How does it affect your life and what can be done to fix this problem, okay?
That's right. We got to stop there, Peter. Thank you very much. And looking forward to the latest edition of Crosstalk, because I just
always
enjoy
it. Look forward to having you on again very soon.
Me too. Thank you very much, Peter. Appreciate it.
All right.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.